Club now.
This is Kara Schaefer, and I'm here with Vanessa Snowden and Sebastian Farja. And we are doing an interview for the Brooklyn Historical Society. And Vanessa, I'll start with you.
Sure.
If you could tell me a little bit about where you were born and what your childhood was like, who your parents were.
So I was born in Caracas, Venezuela. And I moved to the States pretty soon thereafter. I was only about a year old. My dad is American. He was in Caracas because he got a job playing French horn in the orchestra there, and my mom happened to be his Spanish teacher. He didn't speak any Spanish at all when he went, and so they met in class, and my mom asked my dad out, because my dad's the shy one, and, you know, they fell in love, and then I suddenly came along unexpectedly, and so then they got married and ended up moving to the States because they thought that I would have sort of better opportunities over there. We moved to Buffalo because that's where my grandparents lived and that's where my dad grew up, and that's pretty much where I spent most of my childhood. It's funny because this interview is all about sort of cross-cultural families, and I grew up like that myself. Like I said before, my dad's American, my mom's Venezuelan, so our household was always kind of a mix of different cultures, and, you know, Spanish and English were always flying back and forth. I feel like it was a good thing for me. Like, I learned a lot, and especially, like, learning the language, like, having two languages in the household was really useful to me. But I also missed out on so many, like, typical cultural American things, because my dad is kind of a classical music / computer nerd, and, like, my mom's Venezuelan, so I grew up either listening to, like, Tchaikovsky or salsa music. So, like, I didn't know who the Beatles were, or, like, the Rolling Stones, or, like, any of these, like, really famous musical groups until, you know, high school, if not college. So I feel like I was very much enriched by my childhood experience, but at the same time, it's just funny, like, the gaps in knowledge that I have because of who my parents are and what they valued and still value.
Do you remember the point at which you realized that you had different cultural references than your peers?
Super early on. Like, my friends, like, in elementary school, they would call my house and they wouldn't understand my mom on the phone because of her accent. So, and I grew up in a town, I mean, my high school had, I was the only, like, half Hispanic kid. There's one half Jew, like, no black people, like, no, there's one Asian kid, and then everyone else is, like, just plain old white bread families. So for them, I was always kind of an anomaly. I also really liked that difference. Like, I don't know, when I was in second grade, for some reason, I insisted on singing La Bamba to every classroom in the elementary school. Like, I convinced my teacher to let me do this. I just went around and sang La Bamba to every class. And I remember, like, all these kids just looking at me like I was some strange creature, but I just loved it. I was like, I'm so different from you. Like, listen to my fun song in Spanish. It was kind of funny. But, I mean, it was very early on. I always knew that I was different from the other kids. And for them, it was always a good thing. It became more difficult in high school when it came to applying to college, because when I got into Princeton, suddenly everyone who thought it was cool that I was from Venezuela attributed the fact that I got in there to the fact that I was Hispanic. And so that became really difficult for me because, you know, I thought I had earned it, and suddenly, like, all of these kind of weird feelings were coming up around my heritage because, you know, I only got where I was getting to because of this, according to my peers. So that was the only time that I felt a little bit weird about being sort of half American and half Venezuelan, because I didn't know which one counted more. And I always felt weird, like, having to check off that box and be like, yeah, sure, I'm Hispanic. I mean, I did it because I knew it would give me an advantage. But at the same time, I grew up in the States. I didn't really know my family in Venezuela that much. So I didn't really feel that Hispanic, like, but I also didn't feel American. So it was really, that was always really hard for me to identify myself in one way or another. And I think now they have, like, the other box where you can check that off and write stuff in. But at the time, it was like, you have to pick whether you're white or Hispanic. And so making that decision was a little difficult.
Were you close to your grandparents on your father's side?
Yeah, definitely. I grew up with them. So I was really close with my grandmother. I'm the oldest grandchild that she has. So she sort of had a special attachment to me as well. My grandpa was always a little more, or is a little more distant, so I didn't know him as well, but I'm definitely really close with my grandma.
Was there ever any discussion about the fact that your father had gone to Venezuela and met someone and brought her back?
Yeah, well, it's funny because my other uncle also randomly married a Venezuelan woman, which is, like, it's weird because in my family, my dad's side of the family, there's, like, no one else who's married outside of, like, typical American cultural milieu. And all of a sudden you have, like, my dad and his younger brother who both married Venezuelan women. So my dad was the first one to kind of go off and get some exotic woman. But when my mom came to the States with him, with me, they actually moved in with my grandparents. And my mom didn't speak English at all. And she said that she would basically just stay in the room upstairs all day with me because she was too afraid to, like, go downstairs and, you know, talk to my dad's family. Because they can be difficult, too. Like, they're wonderful, but they didn't really know how to deal with my mom. And my mom was really shy and also just didn't really know what to do and didn't really have the self-confidence to sort of put herself out there. I mean, she came from, like, a tiny town in Venezuela, and now all of a sudden she's, like, she'd never seen snow before, she'd never been in weather below, like, 70 degrees, and it was just a huge culture shock for her. And it was really, really hard for her, which is why she was so protective of me when I, like, up and went to France without speaking the language and without anything. For her, she was also really nervous about me marrying Seb because she had a really different experience with that. She felt like she was completely powerless when she came to the States, that she didn't have anything, that she couldn't take care of herself, and so she didn't want that for me. But the way that I saw it very differently, like, first of all, she didn't have a college degree or anything, like, and, you know, I had already gotten my education, like, I was going of my own accord, I didn't have kids, like, I was going to learn a language. It was a really different set of circumstances. I felt like I was on, like, the same sort of level as Seb, whereas my mom always felt like she needed my father at the beginning, just because she was so helpless in the States without him. And this was the first time she had traveled, and I had traveled before, so it was always a weird dynamic because my mom wanted to protect me from what the cultural shock that she had gone through, but it was always just a very different situation for me.
Do you remember any stories that she told you about that sort of exemplifies that cultural shock?
Well, I mean, I think the main thing was just her spending just days and days on end just in the room with me and just having no contact, like, no one to talk to. You know, her family was so far away. Like, at the time, you know, now we don't really have long distance calls that are expensive, but at the time, like, you know, we didn't have money to call Venezuela. She felt very, very, very isolated. And also, we were in the suburbs of Buffalo. It's not like there's a real Hispanic population there to speak of. So it took her a long time, like, before she even really made any friends. Her first friend was Anna, you know, Anna, who's awesome. She actually married a Jewish guy from Chicago. It was mostly at first to sort of, like, get her paperwork in the States. She's from Costa Rica, but they've been together forever. But she met her, my mom, we had already moved into our house on Linwood, which is the first house that my parents had on their own. They rented it. It was where I lived until I was probably, like, 5 or 6, and my mom had gone to the grocery store, and apparently the way they met was I had just like stolen a cookie or something. Like, so she had me in the car and I reached over. There was like a, I don't know, like a bakery area of the supermarket with like cookies out. And so I just like stole a cookie and was munching on it. And Anna thought it was like the funniest thing. So she came over and started speaking to me in Spanish. And my mom was like, "What? You speak Spanish?" And she was like so psyched because she had been starved for anyone who spoke her language. And so they became friends and have really been really almost like sisters ever since. But yeah, it was for my mom. That's always been a struggle for her is coming here to the States. It was a lot of times she says that she almost regrets it. Because she felt like I didn't really get to be brought up like with that true Hispanic sort of culture that she calls her own, but at the same time I wouldn't have been afforded the same opportunities over there, and also now with the way things are with Chavez and everything, I mean she's obviously happy to be here, but she definitely sometimes regrets that.
And did you spend any time in Venezuela?
Yeah, not much though, especially at the beginning. I mean, my family just was, like, very poor because my mom, like, she didn't have a job. She was a housewife, and my dad was playing in the Buffalo Philharmonic working a second job as well. So we couldn't really afford to spend $1,000 per person to get out there. But we would go from time to time. It was only when I was older, like, probably the first time I went back, I was probably, like, 7 or 8, and then we went every few years after that. But I always felt, I was always really scared when we would go back because I felt like I wasn't Hispanic enough and like that I should speak Spanish better and not with an accent because I speak with an accent. And so going there was always definitely anxiety provoking for me. Because my mom was, like, a totally different person. She was, like, totally into it. And then, you know, they want me to salsa dance, and I didn't want to dance. Like, I was such an awkward kid. And, you know, they'd be there, and they'd be like, "Here, come dance with your cousin Bruno." And I'd be like, "Oh, I really don't want to dance in front of you, and I don't know how to dance, especially not salsa." I always kind of felt apart. Like, I didn't really fit in either place.
Did you ever make any friends with your relatives in Venezuela? Or
not really. Like, my mom would force me to, like, go spend the night with, like, a second cousin, and I would just be, like, traumatized because I'd be, like, afraid to ask to go to the bathroom, and, like, I would just, like, I felt totally out of my element. Now I'm very different. Like, I think having those experiences early on made me more confident in new situations later, but, man, at the beginning, like, I just never really felt comfortable. So there weren't a lot of people my age kind of around. So I think that made a difference too.
Yeah. So you talked about going to Princeton. And do you want to talk about sort of the lead up to meeting Seb?
Sure. Well, all right. So at Princeton, my senior thesis was about all of these different sort of French theorists and philosophers, but I didn't speak French at all. I didn't read it. I didn't ever take a French class. And when I graduated, I really had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I was, you know, like an angsty college kid who was like, I don't want to make money, and all these Princeton kids, all they want to do is go to Wall Street and make money, and I don't want to be that person, and whatever. So I basically had no clue what I was going to do at all. And so my friend Lonnie and my roommate, she had found this opportunity to go be an au pair for an alum who lived in Lyon. And I was actually at the time interviewing to be an intern, well, kind of like an assistant to a professor who was doing oral histories in Caracas, which was really cool. And so I was going to do that, and then this other opportunity came up, and I was like, I don't know what to do, and I just, on a total whim, just decided to go to Lyon. Off I went, and I got in contact, through the family and through the previous au pair, I got in contact with our friend Mel, well, Seb's friend, Mel, at the time. She was kind of the previous au pair's friend there. She's Jamaican, but she grew up going to French school. Is that what it was? And then she was going to school in Lyon. In Switzerland? Why was she in Lyon? Oh, because she was dating David. No.
Yeah, when she was a kid, she went to school in Switzerland because her dad worked at the UN.
Right.
That's why she speaks French, and that's why she went to Lyon to school.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she was there, and but she speaks like English and French, totally perfectly. Like her French, she speaks with like no accent at all. And so I met up with her, and then she's like, "Oh, well, I'll introduce you to like the French guys that I know." And, like, all the people that I know. Because, basically, like, Seb and his crew of friends were, like, hung out with all of the au pairs for this family, like, through Mel. Like, there are how many? There are two or three that you knew before me. Two before me.
Two. Yeah. Two.
Right. So, Ben.
Three.
Three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Three. Yeah.
Right.
One was a bitch.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I was like the next in line. So, you know, we went out and I met them all and I was like, oh, okay, whatever, they're cool. And so Seb was one of the people with whom I went out with on that first momentous night. And I was really not interested in a relationship with him at first. Like, I was just like, oh, he's super nice and we hung out and everything. But apparently Seb had a crush on me. I was just like, no, I think we should just be friends, and then not. And he was quite persistent, just ended up kind of happening like that. But we were very good friends for, I guess it was like, I mean, 3 or 4 months really before anything happened romantically. But, yeah, so that's kind of how that went.
Sounds good. Maybe we want to shift gears.
Sure.
Seb, do you want to tell me about where you grew up, your early life, what your parents were like?
Sure. So I was born in Lyon. My dad is he's an electrician. He works for the equivalent of Con Edison here. And my mom, she's I don't know how to say that. She's a buyer. She buys fabrics for this
lingerie
company. So I was born in Lyon. Then when I was 2 or 3 years old, we moved to the suburbs, like 30 miles away from Lyon in a house because my sister was born. So my parents wanted to. So until I was 10 or 11, we moved there. Then my parents got divorced, and my mom moved back to Lyon to be closer to her parents. And I always lived in the same area, or either in Lyon or just outside.
Did you live in the suburb, or did you live in Lyon, or did you switch off?
So until I was 10 years old, I was living in a suburb, like really, like almost the countryside was, and then moved back to Lyon until I was in middle school. But then we moved back to in the suburbs, but really just outside Lyon, so it was still the city until I was 18, and then we moved back to Lyon. In the city center when I started university.
And what was your childhood like? Who did you play with or grow up around?
So I most remember it was in Saint-Priest. It's where I went to middle school, when I met most of my friends that I'm still friends with now. So Saint-Priest, like the suburb, is not. It's not poor, but it's not rich, so it's really mixed. Like, there was like a lot of, not like Vanessa when she was the only white Hispanic kid. Me, I was not the only white, but it was like really mixed. Like, we had like black kids, Arabs, Asians, so that was really diverse. And my friends were...
The class clowns.
Yeah, I was one of the class clowns. So I wasn't, I wasn't really serious at school, but I wasn't mean or anything, but like, so.
Like, what kinds of things would you do?
What kind of things would I do?
Play.
Yeah, so for example, the teacher will talk to one of the kids, and she will let the kids on my desk, and I will throw them out the window.
No, but tell them about the competition.
Yeah.
Because that was part of the whole competition you guys
yeah.
had.
So in France, they give you like this book. It's like the way teacher talks to your parents. They will put note on them. When is the next parents-teacher conference? So,
when your kid threw my keys out the window.
So that was called the observation. So if you get 3 observations, then you get another call. It's when you have to stay after school.
Detention. Right.
Yeah. So when you get 3 of them, so every time you get 1, you have to have it signed. So it could be Sebastian threw my keys out of the window. And I have to have that sign to my mom. So I said, yeah, to the keys. I don't know.
And what was the reaction of your mother?
She was pissed, but like she will take my PlayStation away for a week or stuff like that. But it wasn't, it was never really bad stuff. Like, so she was mad, but never too mad. Maybe not enough. Cause, so we had this competition when was the we had to get the most observation in a year, and I came second.
Right, but the keys are like the your last hurrah, right? Like, wasn't it? Like at the very end, you guys were just like doing whatever.
Yeah, it was like the last week, and I lost. I lost because this kid he just started to sing in the class. So like on his desk, stand up on his desk. So that was middle school. Then high school, I started to get more serious. I was better at school, and I stopped the competition. And but I still did some stuff like that in Spanish class, which I regret now because I can't speak Spanish.
What would you do to that Spanish teacher?
Oh, yeah, we'll still sing in the class. So.
Wasn't that, didn't Ben come in and pretend to be a student? Wasn't that the teacher?
Yeah, I had, had a friend who took a German, but he would come in Spanish class, and the teacher was kind of out of it. She would come and she'd say, oh, there's one more than usual, and I would tell her, that's better than one more than one less. She would say, oh yeah, of course, she would just do stuff. But I was more serious in high school, and I had friends that were kind of my style, not mean, but like not really serious either.
And so for college, you got more serious.
Yeah.
In high school, and you were looking to college. Do you remember making that decision about where, what to do and where to go?
Yeah, the last year of high school, I didn't know what to do. And I just chose the same thing as my friends. It was like economy stuff, management. So yeah, why not? I had like good grades in economy, but I didn't like it. So first, I spent 2 years at the university, then I dropped out, then I did another thing, was called a vocational diploma, but I took like par correspondance.
Like the internet today.
Yeah, correspondence course.
Yeah, correspondence course. So I did that.
Sure.
I got the diploma.
But didn't you not do anything till like the night before?
Yeah, I didn't really study. I was just
screwing around.
Screwing around with the au pairs.
Wait, that was before my time.
Yeah. Go out every night. Like I didn't have to go to school, but I still did that. Correspondent thing. I don't know how, but I got the diploma, which I was really proud because only like 3 or 4% of the kids will do the course, like the correspondent course will get the diploma. So I got that, and then I went back to university. I started like this security thing because I wanted to work for an NGO, like be like management, in NGO management. So I did that. I got my diploma at this time. I was more serious. That was Vanessa's time when she was in Lyon.
So at this time, all of these au pairs that your particular friend group would hang out with, were all in Lyon?
So Ben, the friend we talked, like who would come in Spanish classes, he moved to with his dad to New Caledonia, and then he came back to Lyon. And he lived in this student residence, and he met the first au pair. So she was an American Canadian girl that liked to go out a lot. So
she was crazy.
She was crazy.
She was basically an alcoholic.
Yes. So I went out a lot this year, and And then when he left with her in Canada, but I still kept contact with the family that she was au pair with. So I met the other au pair. And then when I was in university, most of my friends in university were Erasmus students. That's the
study abroad
exchange program between European universities. So I had a lot of English-speaking friends when I was in university. When Vanessa arrived, she was the last au pair.
The latest,
yeah.
I wasn't the last because there was what's-her-face afterwards. What was her name?
Yeah, Emma.
Emma.
That's the one I didn't like.
Right.
That's the fourth one.
Yeah,
because Vanessa stayed 2 years. She stayed for 1 year as an au pair and 1 year as a English teacher assistant. So we both knew the
next au pair.
The next au pair,
right.
Yeah. And, so I had a lot of foreign students' friends, and that's how that's how I started to learn speak English for real. Because in school, as I said, I wasn't really the most serious student. But and then Vanessa, after 2 years, she wanted to.
Wait. Do you remember when you met Vanessa? Do you remember the day you met Vanessa?
Yeah, I do. I do. It was. So it was through mail. She said, "Yeah, we should go out tonight. It's Vanessa's. Was probably your first weekend."
Mm-hmm.
And, so mail told me, "Yeah, she's really cute." And like, so I thought, "Oh, sure, why not? We'll go out." So I met her at the same student residence that my friend lived in, because all the au pairs, the family, would rent an apartment at this residence. And yeah, I remember I had a car and
call it sub-service because he was the only one who had a car. He would just drive everyone everywhere.
Yeah.
He had this beat-up Clio. it was really funny.
And yeah, I remember she didn't speak French
at all.
So I spoke a little English. So I asked her dumb questions like, "Do you like, you know, do you like to go out?" Stuff like that.
Wait. And then they'd like chatter off on the side and be like, "No, what are they saying?"
Because we went out with my friends, the boys.
David and Olivier.
And Jean-Christian.
And Jean-Christian, all right.
So they will push me, go, and they're like, I was pretty shy, so. But they put a lot of pressure on me. And I saw she was so. We were at the table, there was Mel, me, and maybe Jean-Christian, Olivier, and David. And so Vanessa, she was kind of lost.
Mm.
We were speaking French really fast and with some slang.
It wouldn't have mattered if you guys were speaking slowly.
Yeah.
I understood.
And then we went out more and more because we had like mutual friends. there's those Mexican brothers that lived in the same residence for 3 or 4 years. So I was really friend with them. Mel was friend with them as well, and Vanessa got friends. So we all go out together. And that's how we finally started to.
But do you remember the moment when you knew you guys were going to be dating?
I mean, well, we made out, so. I guess that was.
I think it was a night and we went out.
We went out and Ben was being a brat. Remember, Ben was all in a bad mood. I don't remember why.
Yeah.
He's in a bad mood, so then we went.
But I stayed overnight at your place.
Right.
Because I think I was probably too drunk to drive back to, even though it was 5 minutes away. So I said, yeah, you can stay overnight. And then.
One thing led to another. I don't know if our grandkids want to hear about this.
So then.
But I wanted to for a long time, but she wasn't really interested, but I was persistent.
I remember in the morning before you left, you asked, he's like, oh, so the next time I see you, are we gonna kiss like this? And then he did like the bees on each cheek, and he said, or are we gonna kiss like this? And he gave me a kiss on the lips, and then I was like, oh my gosh, I was like, well, I guess like this, and I kissed him back on the lips, and that kind of sealed the deal.
Did you guys ever have a discussion about, are we together?
No, I think that was pretty much it. Because, like, the thing is, we were spending so much time together already that when it kind of crossed over into dating, like, we couldn't be casual about it. You know, like, we're already really, really close, spending all this time together, and then it was like, all right, well, when we made that move, we weren't going to start seeing each other less. So it became very serious very quickly.
And she had her own apartment, and I was spending a lot of time there. So yeah, it became.
And then the second year, we moved in together.
So
we started dating in January, and then the school year ended, and I went back to the States over the summer. And then you came and visited me.
I came, yeah.
Right. And then I went back for the second sort of scholastic year that I was there, and then we moved in together.
First, we lived at my mom's for...
Yeah, right, until we could move into Cecile's place.
Because I had a friend that was moving to Marseille, and she had, like, this nice apartment.
It was a government-subsidized apartment.
So she was paying, like, 200 euros a month.
No, but there were months we would pay, like, 80 euros for a one-bedroom...
And there's, a huge waiting list to get those. And she had one, and she was moving with her boyfriend, but she didn't know if it was going to last, so she didn't want to
give up
the apartment.
Right.
So she subletted it to us because we were looking for something not too expensive. Because
I was only working part-time.
Yeah, no, I was part-time, too.
You were part-time. You were working at Dalti.
Yeah, but I was going to school still, right? I think. Yeah, it was my last year, so I was working, like, I had a student job and she had a student job as well. So in the meantime, and she was moving in at the end of October, around my birthday, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first 2 months, we lived at my mom's place. So that was not like with your mom, because
no,
at the time
not at
she
all.
Could speak French, and and my mom is pretty cool, so.
She's cool.
Yeah, so how long did it take you to be up to a level of conversational friends?
I don't know. It's probably
really
a better
fast.
Question for Seb to answer, because I kind of felt uncomfortable for a long time, but I progressed pretty quickly because I didn't really have a choice. But I don't really know when I started speaking, like...
Yeah, it was really fast. Like, she's really good at languages. I was really impressed. Like, maybe 3 months, 3-4 months, she could, like, follow a conversation and... Yeah, because you had, like, Jean-Ki was her best friend. She's a Scottish, and she was in French for more than you.
Yeah.
And I could evaluate, like...
Based on Jean-Ki?
Yeah, based on
Jean-Ki.
Both will improve, and
Well, it helped too that I grew up speaking like with Spanish
French, yeah.
as because it was another Romance language. So it helped a lot. And really, I studied like a textbook. There's a, my mom has a friend who's Belgian who taught with her because my mom ended up being a she eventually became a Spanish high school Spanish teacher. So another the French teacher at the school she became good friends with. And so she gave me she kind of tutored me over the summer. And so I learned stuff like in a textbook. Which was funny because I, you know, I learned some stuff, but obviously, like, not really how to speak. But once I was immersed in it and I had to know how to speak it to sort of get along, I picked it up pretty quickly. It was hard at the beginning. You just tune out. It takes so much energy to just follow a conversation. So sometimes they'd be yapping away, and I'd like tune out. And when people laughed, I would laugh and just be like, sort of, I'm pretending to follow the conversation, but it was definitely really tiring doing all the paperwork that I had to do for my visa. Because forget it, you go to the préfecture, like the I guess the I don't know, like the city hall, or well, not really that same thing, but to go take care of like my visa stuff, and they don't care that you don't speak French. Like I was there for like a couple of weeks, and I would go, I'd be like, I need a timbre. And they'd be like, well, we don't understand you. And I'd be like, oh, I hate you. Make an effort. But that was definitely hard. But those guys were always so nice. And Seb spoke English pretty well. So I would always be able to sort of switch over if I needed to, which was nice because, I mean, I guess my dad spoke Spanish too, so my mom could sort of do that. But I just felt like in French, I always felt like I couldn't express myself intellectually as well as I can in English. Like, so I know I'm a smart person, but in French, I felt like my IQ dropped, like, so much. And so when I would speak in French, it would be frustrating because I'd want to express an idea and I wouldn't be able to at the same level that I could in English. But a lot of times with Seb, I could just switch over, and so I didn't, like, necessarily feel that way with him. Telling stories, when I knew that I could speak French was when I could actually tell a story to someone else. Instead of just having like a present tense conversation, like, yes, I like Lyon and I would like to order the shrimp and can I have a beer? Like, the moment when I knew I could speak it was when I could recount something from my, you know, from when I lived in the States or from the week before or something and actually, presented in such a way that was compelling and interesting, like a good story. That was always the hardest thing. It's still hard.
Do you guys want to take a break now? And then we can eat and come back to your life in Brooklyn?
Sounds good. Sure.
Alright, so we're continuing the interview with Vanessa and Seb. And you guys were talking about how you had met in Lyon. And then you started living together the second year. You came back, Vanessa. You guys want to take it from there?
Sure. Okay. I can go. Did you have a good story to tell?
Yeah, I can tell about when we decided to get married.
Okay.
So Vanessa was finishing her second year as an English teacher assistant. That was also basically the end of a visa, so she had to go back to the U.S. And so at this point it was either she would stay in France or I would move to the U.S. And we didn't really know how to do that. I know she wanted to come back here and...
At the time, I wanted to go back and get my master's.
Yeah, I wanted to go back and get her master's. So, it was your birthday, right?
Mm-hmm.
We went to a Japanese restaurant, and we were talking about that. What are we going to do? We don't want to split up, obviously. And she said, why don't we just get married? And I started laughing.
She's like, oh, that's funny. And I was like,
we were dating like for 6 months.
Right.
So, and maybe more than that, but
because
January, November.
Right,
like
right.
Seven months, and then I saw that she wasn't kidding, and I thought, all right, okay, so let's just get married. And
let's do it.
Let's do it, yeah. And later on we met, the same night we met my friends at a bar, and I told them, yeah, we're going to get married. So we decided, just like that.
Telling your mom was a different story.
Yeah. So at this point we thought that we would get married in France. I got my paperwork here, and then we'll move to the U.S. That was the
right
plan.
Like, we weren't going to have a whole big ceremony. It was just going to be like, we'll just go to City Hall and do it, because really neither of us come to the idea of marriage with like a very traditional family structure. His parents got divorced, my parents were separated on again, off again, like pretty much my entire life growing up, so neither of us were very big into the traditional notion of marriage. For us, it was like, well, we want to stay together, and this is pretty much the only way to do it. So we weren't really big into, like, whole big ceremony, like, white dress. Like, I had never dreamed about any of that crap. And, I mean, Seb, I know, was really wanted to get the white wedding dress. I told him it was my day.
Yeah.
So anyway, I called my mom, and I was like, hey, Ma, Seb and I are getting married. We're just going to go to City Hall. And Mom's like, the hell you are? So Mom is, you know, like a spicy Hispanic lady who is really just really wanted to like do the whole big wedding thing. And this was, again, like kind of a projection of like her relationship with my dad, because they went to City Hall and got married. So they never had the big wedding. So when her firstborn daughter said that she was going to do the same thing, it was just like in that same narrative that my mom like felt that I was repeating of hers. And so she was like, no, you have to have a whole, like, we have to have a real wedding, you have to have a dress, and, like, we're doing it in Buffalo. And I was like, okay. I was like, well, we're gonna just do it in France and make it easy. She's like, no, like, you're the bride, we're doing it in Buffalo, like, there's no way we're going to France. So I was like, okay. So I told Seb, and so it came time that we had to, like, tell his mom, which was a little nerve-wracking for me. Because he had lived with his mom. Like, when we started dating, he was still living, like, at home, because in France, well, really in Europe in general, people kind of live at home a lot longer. So, first, I took her son and, like, had him move in with me, and then I was going to have him get married in the States and move to the States. So it was kind of like, oh, I'm a little nervous. I'll tell your mom.
So we invited her and my sister for dinner.
Yeah,
at our
on our, I was like, we have to do it on our turf. And I made arepas. I was like, we're eating my food, and we're doing it on my turf, because otherwise I can't pull it off.
So I told her, yeah, we're going to get married. And she was kind of shocked. Yeah, she was
like literally in shock.
Because I told her, yeah, we're going to get married at the end of August in Buffalo. So she was like, okay, so you're getting married. We have to get the plane tickets. We have to.
No, she had to repeat. She was like, okay, you're getting married in the States in August. Okay, so August, you're getting married, and it'll be in the States in August, and you'll be getting married. And I was like, yes.
Yeah. And my sister was laughing.
Right, because your mom was like freaking out. And I was like, oh my God, I just wanted to crawl into a hole and die. But, I mean, she took it well.
Yeah,
I mean,
she took it well. She was.
After the initial shock, don't do that.
And, so yeah, so we started to
plan that.
Yeah. You moved back in June or July?
Mm-hmm.
And,
so we had to do all the paperwork for it. So, it's a huge pain, because we had to get a fiancé visa so he could come and get married. Because you can't just, like, go in as a tourist and get married in the States. Like, you have to apply for a specific visa. So we applied for it in February for a wedding in August, at the end of August. August 25th was when we were supposed to get married. So we figured, like, that is more than enough time. It's fine. Well, they ended up changing the law for the fiancé visa after we had sent in our application. And so it's not like the old law applied to us, like the new law applied, so they had to send us this. First of all, they had to come up with a new questionnaire that went along with the law, which was basically a law to protect mail order brides. So they had to come up with the questionnaire and then send it to us, and we had to send it back. And meanwhile, we're like planning a whole wedding and none of the paperwork is going through. So the only way that I found out about all this stuff is because after sending our application into this black hole and not hearing anything back at all for months, I like started calling like politicians. Like I called like Hillary Clinton, because she was our senator at the time, like Schumer, called him. Their offices, they were nice, but like whatever, nothing ever came of it. Like they never actually got back to me. And then I called my congressman and a dude in his office, like called around for me. Because I mean, there are representatives, like isn't that their job? Whenever I tell the story, people are like, really? That's, I was like, that's their job. They represent you like to the government. Come on. So this guy found out all this stuff, and so he was giving us all this information. Meanwhile, there were tons of couples who had no idea what was going on with their application. So finally they sent me the questionnaire and stuff like, have you ever been accused or convicted of rape or incest or like domestic abuse? And I was like, no, no, no. It was like a stupid checklist thing. So we sent that back, and we were just waiting. And so I was basically just like calling this congressman guy every day, and then he was calling the people that he knew in the Department of Homeland Security, and it was just like all this back and forth. So finally we find out that the application, and like we get these things like, yeah, well, it's been shipped off to Vermont, and now it's like en route to Washington, D.C. We're like, what? Why is this being trucked around everywhere? So finally we hear it's actually in France where it needs to be, like at the embassy, and we're just like waiting for Seb to get the call from the embassy saying come in for the interview and then he could come to the States. But at this point it's a week before the wedding. Like my family in the States have all bought their tickets, like the cake is bought, like everything's done, the dress, the like all the planning and everything. His family from France has bought their tickets, like everybody's ready to be in Buffalo except for the groom. And we're just sitting there. I'm calling the embassy every day. I'm getting up at 4 in the morning to call them when they open. And he went to Paris and was staying with Ben and was just camping outside of the embassy waiting for them to call him. So he had his ticket and everything because he was just going to come over on a tourist visa. Actually, you know what? We ended up getting, we pushed the wedding back, or I guess forward or back. Like, so we pushed it into the September because we figured, like, they told us, like, we just need one more week. Like, it'll surely come through in a week. And the day of Seb's on his way to the airport to fly on a tourist visa, and they call him, and they're like, okay, we're ready to interview you. And he's like, I can't. I'll miss my flight and the wedding. Like, I can't do it. So he got on the plane and came over as a tourist, and we had a fake wedding with everybody there. We just, like, we had everything, like, the same way. We just didn't sign any paperwork. And it was really fun. We did it. The whole thing was in Spanish, French, and English, because my family in Venezuela doesn't speak French or English, and his family speaks some English, but not really that much. So all three languages were represented, so there was a reading in each language, and it was cute. It was small, but it was really nice. And then right afterwards, so basically right before the wedding, I didn't see Seb for 2 months. That entire summer, I didn't see him at all. So I saw
this
him.
Is when you looked for an apartment here.
Right, yeah. And I was looking, I came to New York to find an apartment and a job because we were moving here. Calling the embassy. When he finally went in, who was it that told you, like, about me calling them every day?
Yeah, the lady at the...
When you went in?
Yeah.
Oh.
Said you have to tell your wife to stop calling every day.
I call every day. Be like, so, how's, like, the file and blah, blah, blah. I called them every day. I was so annoying. They probably hated me. I was nice, though. I wasn't... Maybe I was a little incest. So then, right after the wedding, Seb left again because he had to go back and finish the paperwork. And then he got... we drove to New York. Our honeymoon was basically driving our U-Haul across New York State and moving into our apartment at Wyckoff in Brooklyn, so kind of Bushwick area. So we we were like, well, instead of going on a honeymoon, we'll just move to Brooklyn. So we drove our U-Haul across New York and moved into our apartment here. And then as soon as we got settled, Seb went back to France, finished his paperwork, and then he came back with that all set. And I told my boss one day, I was like, you mind if I take the rest of the afternoon off because I'm going to go get married at City Hall? I was like, what? Okay, sure. So then we went with my two friends from college, Rachel and Rosie. They were our witnesses. And we went to City Hall and got hitched.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, we ended up getting married the way that we initially had planned we would have done it, which was super low-key and just like us and two of our friends. And that was kind of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then your mom planned the whole thing. And
yeah, and we had another wedding in France with...
In April.
In April, yeah.
Oh.
With the French family and friends. So.
Right. Oh, and what was funny, too, so we count our anniversary as September 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
So our original date was supposed to be August 25th. The date we count is the fake one with all of our families, September 2nd. But our actual date that we got married was October 8th.
Yeah, the one in Seattle.
We don't know. So
we
when he
remember.
So in France, he had to go like register our marriage, right? He went, and the lady's like, "So what's the date?" And so I was like,
"October 5th."
He's like, "I'll have to get back to you on that one." Meanwhile, like we had gone through all of this work to prove that it wasn't a fake wedding. Like we had to have notarized testimony from friends. We had to have photos, bills, like things that prove that we were together as a couple beforehand. And then he goes to get registered and he doesn't know the date.
Yeah, I have to call them back the next day because I didn't give them the right one.
Did she question that?
No, because she didn't care. She was the French authorities.
Mm-hmm.
That's
so
the US
care.
One that,
right.
That cares. She was a that's a real wedding, right?
Yeah. But then we had the other one in France, like a ceremony, because
mm-hmm.
my mom really wanted to do that. So I got to wear my dress again. So I basically had three weddings. All of the same guy.
Yeah.
All the same dude.
Yeah.
It was cool, though, that I got to wear my dress more than once. So that was good.
So why did you decide to move to Brooklyn?
Well, I figured New York was the easiest place for both of us to get a job. Because originally I wanted to go to grad school in Buffalo, but it didn't really work out. Like, I didn't get enough money to do it. And I was like, you know what, screw it. Let's just move to New York. And I didn't really know anything about New York at all. So I just started researching neighborhoods and what was actually affordable for us, since I had a job, but he didn't. And he also couldn't work for a while, because he had his fiancé visa, but it takes a while for him to get his work authorization. So the first couple of months, you technically couldn't work. You were just kind of chilling. Well, you were doing a Emile Lissekosh.
Yeah, there's four months.
4 months was
it?
Was that long? But you were working under the table for those other guys. Or was
that like a temporary authorization.
Yeah.
But they will give me like a authorization that can work for 30 days, but you cannot find a job.
A 30-day job.
Yeah. So
but, so anyway, we were looking for a neighborhood that would be fun and affordable. And so we saw Williamsburg, but then we were too poor to actually, like, live in Williamsburg. So we saw that, like, Bushwick was really kind of the...
East Williamsburg.
Right, it was East Williamsburg, really. And so found an apartment there, which I thought was pretty awesome. Like, it was newly renovated and everything. And then we moved in. And it turned out that first of all, the walls were super thin. And second of all, we had crazy kids who went to the School of Visual Arts who were really like to party and would, they were like writing an opera for a synthesizer while taking various drugs and just were like so loud. The guy was like always breaking up with and then having makeup sex with his girlfriend. Just loudly, like, and everywhere in the apartment, like, you couldn't get away from it. And I had signed a 2-year lease. And so, and there was the bodega, so we were on the on the second floor. No, on the first floor.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, on the second floor for, yeah, for Americans, right. So you're on the second floor, and on the first floor was this bodega. So kids next door would party until 4:30 in the morning. Then bodega would start up their, like, march music, like the bum, 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 at 5 a.m. And the bass would just go straight through our floor. So forget it. For 2 years, I, like, did not sleep. The first year, I was doing random office jobs, but the second year was the year I started the Fellows. And then I was teaching full-time and going to grad school. And then, like, these crazy kids and the bodega. It was rough. I was like, oh, my gosh, I can't. And how do you know? It's so hard. Like, I just came and got the apartment. I stayed here with my friend Rachel for a week. And I was like, I have to find an apartment in this week. And you just don't. You just make kid mistakes, rookie mistakes. And that was a rookie mistake. It's a pretty good one. So when we looked for our second apartment, we were a little more discerning. We also had more money by that time. But yeah, so that's how we ended up in Bushwick, and then in a little more Williamsburg-ish area.
Can you tell me about some of the friends you've made while you've been here?
Can I talk about you guys?
You can talk about us, if it's relevant.
I'm sure. I guess I'm pretty bad at keeping friends when I don't see them. I'm very much like, my friends in my city are who I kind of connect with more, and I've always been like that, and I've traveled a lot, so I feel like I have sort of pockets of people, but the folks who I live close to are usually the ones, like, in my life at the moment, like, the most important. And I met a lot of people through the teaching fellows. So my friend Amanda, I met her in grad school. And she used to live in Brooklyn with her. Actually, she might be someone you could talk to. I mean, they're both American, but her, well, Zach is Japanese. His family's Japanese. But she lived in Brooklyn for a while. Now they live on the Upper West Side. But, yeah, I mean, she's just, like, another teacher. She's my little sister's age. She's Erica's age. So that's kind of, I feel like it's sort of a little bit of a different relationship with her. But, yeah, she's great. And then there's Bennett, who Erica knows, obviously, and was friends with before. Bennett was another teacher friend of mine. Really, all of my friends here are teachers, except for, like, the few friends that I have here from college. Just because, I don't know, I feel like especially when you teach in New York City, you just really make connections to the other people who are doing the same thing and going through the same stuff, because it can be a really trying job, and especially with the political climate right now of education, it's, like, it's really easy to connect with other teachers. So a lot of my friends are teachers. And then there's Karis and Erica, who I met through Bennett, and I guess I got to know Erica, or Erica, as I have to call her, because my sister's name is Erica with a C, and Erica is with a K. And so she hung out with us at my family's farm, which is in the Poconos, and, you know, a fellow lover of food and drink, and we obviously hit it off very well, so that was cool, and through that, we met Karis, who is doing the interview. So those are our friends here, really.
Yay.
Zebby, you have LV. You have your soccer bar friends. You should tell them about.
Yeah. I didn't really make any friends because I had, like, an easy transition from France to the US thanks to Vanessa. So I arrived, the apartment was already found, and she already had friends there that liked to, so the first 4 months I didn't work, so I was at home or doing some volunteer work for NGOs, stuff like that. So I didn't really meet a lot of people. And then my first job was at an hedge fund, and I was the office manager, but all the other people were traders, or so not the same
lifestyle
as me. So I would say the friends I met on my own were the soccer bar people, but were, like, French people, but
Tell them about the soccer bar, because that's important for our cross-cultural.
Where is the soccer bar?
The soccer bar used to be on 3rd.
There's drama here.
Used to be on 3rd and 12 in Union Square. And this is where all Europeans that like soccer used to go to see
they had
European
every game.
Games. They had,
yeah,
like,
they had
every
soccer
games
game.
From every European country. So that was really fun. So I met some people that liked the same team as me, some people from Lyon. And but those guys were often people that were here in New York like for 3 or 4 months or 6 months. But I also met this guy who's half American and half French. His parents are French, but he's born in the US, so now he's American. And he really likes Lyon, so I've been watching games with him like for the last 6 years now.
Oh my god, I can't believe he's been here that long.
So I met the, and he's a really good friend of mine now. And yeah, the other friends I met were at my second job in the
mm-hmm.
French tourism agency. Like there was like French co-workers that left now too because they had like only a 1 year visa or 2 year visa.
Amandine, who was dating Madonna's current boyfriend.
Yeah, which is, and she's from Lyon too, and. Madonna's boyfriend is from Lyon, is one of the
dancers,
hip-hop dancer. And,
Madonna in our time was a very famous pop idol.
Yes.
To the grandkids who do not know who Madonna is. Right, I was told to explain
80s,
any
90s.
Right, to explain any. She might still be going.
Yeah.
She might have once again reinvented herself.
Yeah. So yeah, I was friends with the ex. Friend of
Madonna's
boyfriend
in 2012.
Your claim to fame.
Yes. So I almost dated Madonna. Didn't turn out that way, but.
Have you acquired any interest in American sports, or are you?
Yeah, yeah. I like hockey. Even when I was in France, I was watching, and turns out she was loved hockey too. So. I didn't like American football in France. I thought it was dumb, but now that she explained me the rule and everything, I like it better now.
And you love the song too,
the
Faith
song,
Hill.
The Saturday.
I've
no,
been
Sunday
waiting
night
all
football.
Day for Sunday night.
Yeah,
yeah for Sunday night football.
Yeah, so now I'm waiting
for Sunday
night. And baseball now.
Yeah, well, I'm not
into
baseball either.
Yeah. But yeah, I like it. And basketball, I like. Basketball is huge in Europe too, so that's.
That was an easy
transition. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I play soccer once. Like in the spring and summer, I play soccer here with Americans, and that's fun.
Well, it's a lot of, like, Hispanic dudes too.
Hispanic, yeah.
And
Europeans
some European
too,
guys too, yeah.
And Americans too.
Yeah.
So I meet people there too. I forgot about that.
Yeah. It's interesting, I think, soccer in the United States. So many people play as children.
Right.
But then there's sort of this.
It's recreational. It's not like a lifestyle choice like it is in Europe. Like if you're a kid that's like. Who's playing soccer and has potential, like, you're basically formed to be, like, a star player. Like, all the big clubs have youth teams, and there's a whole system.
Yeah. And I like playing here because, yeah, it's more recreational, and I'm not a really good player. And like, in France, I'm not good at all, but here I'm pretty good. So that's nice. And, yeah, it's a good feeling.
Do you feel more American now, especially with your work guiding tourists who come over from France? Do you feel kind of like a cultural ambassador?
You are a cultural ambassador, technically.
Yeah, I still feel French a lot, like, but I feel like I understand more things going here, like now than when I hear like French people talking about the U.S. I'm like, no, that's not like that. Or, like, I can hear the cliche a lot more than when I was in France. That I would say this thing they say now. Like,
can you give me some example of what would be said?
Like, I don't know. Like about the food, there's a lot of cliche about food. Like, all Americans eat crabs or like eat, McDonald's every day and stuff like
we
that.
We don't eat vegetables.
Yeah, don't eat vegetables. Like, yeah, like French people, they will come here and they're like, huh? There's like fruit and vegetable store here. Yeah? Like, that's even better than in France.
Right, like they see Whole Foods and
yeah,
it's
like,
oh, they have
really nice food. I didn't know that you eat food here. Like, stuff
we,
like.
We didn't know you guys eat food here.
Fruit.
Well, food could have worked.
Yeah, so stuff like that. No, it's, you know, real or...
Well, all the like the stereotypes.
Yeah, that they're all... like, the, that they don't know anything outside of America, so, which some Americans are.
In New York, it's different, too.
Yeah, New York is a lot different.
Do people, when they come over, make that distinction between New York and the rest of
the
America?
Rest of America.
Yeah, because I'll tell them that it's not, like, there's New York and there's...
the rest of the state.
Yeah. And there's New York and the Midwest. So I try to explain that to them.
Do you do tours in Brooklyn ever, or do you tell?
I haven't done
Brooklyn?
Any tour in Brooklyn yet because it's so big that it's not like Manhattan. Manhattan, you can do like a bus tour in 4 hours, and you've seen like, but Brooklyn is different. So, but I tell them, like, because a lot of French people, they like to explore outside of Manhattan, so they will ask me where to go in Brooklyn, and I'll tell them Brooklyn Heights or Williamsburg, if you want to see the hipster.
hipster
games? Yeah, hipster games, hipster capital, stuff like that. But I could do a tour in Brooklyn. Yeah. I worked on like itineraries, like a bike tour, trying to, because there's a lot of stuff to see in Brooklyn. That's cool. So, but yeah, it's so big that it's hard to do a tour there.
Yeah. Vanessa, I want to ask you about your work and more about the cultural environment of your classroom. What kind of kids do you have? And
well, my first teaching job was definitely a culture shock. The school is kind of an underserved population. It was, I would say, 90% black, and then maybe like a smattering of like Hispanic kids, and then like there's like one white kid, so it was kind of like the absolute opposite of like the school that I grew up in. And I didn't, you know, I've had black friends before, but I just didn't realize how unaware I was of the culture and of, I don't know, just like how it just like, it was so different to me. It was like a completely new world. Like, these kids taught me so much, like, just being like assertive as an individual. Like, I came in wanting everyone to like me, like being like the happy little teacher who's gonna be like, yeah, you're gonna love books with me. And these kids are like, I like, really, fuck you. Like, I don't read books. And like, I, you know, and a lot of them just didn't really get the education they deserved. I mean, we talk about public education as a great equalizer, but that's just not true at all. And so I would have 18-year-old freshmen who read at a third grade reading level, and but yet they were all just like so smart and just like knew so much stuff that I didn't know, and had lived through so much more, like so many things that I would just couldn't even imagine living through, just the difficulties in their home lives and navigating living in such difficult neighborhoods. And
can you give an example that you remember?
Like, for example, I had a student one day come in, and she was one of my more bubbly students, but she came in late, and she had her head down on the desk, and just was, like, not responsive. And I was like, what's going on? I was like, you know, naive little teacher, I was like, here, you can write it on a post-it note. Like, you can write me a little note and tell me what's wrong. And she writes on this post-it note, I was just raped. And I you know, I was in the middle of teaching the class, and she, like, hands me this post-it note, and I'm like, I just had no idea what to do. I hadn't been trained in what to do. I just had no idea. And I just kind of stopped everything, and I kind of, like, pulled her aside, and I was like, what's going on? Like, what happened? And it turns out, like, it was one of these situations where she had stayed home to hang out with, like, a friend of her boyfriend's, and, like, you know, they were just, like, hanging out, and apparently he kind of just kept going, and she didn't really know how to say no, and it was, like, one of these situations. And I just felt completely ill-equipped to give her the support she needed. And at my school, like, at the school I taught in before, you know, we have a guidance counselor, but she didn't really care about the students and was rarely ever around. And so we had to, you know, call in the police and, like, have this whole thing. But, like, she didn't want her mom to know because her mom was really strict and didn't know she had stayed home from school, and she felt like it was her fault. And so there are just stories like that, or stories of kids who would come in so high or drunk that they would, you know, throw up in my class, and then I'd call their parents and they'd come in high or drunk. And it just, like, man, I can't. A lot of these kids just had nothing going for them, no support, no one who really cared about them or their well-being. And just early on, I guess just like that whole bright-eyed, bushy-tailed thing when you first go into teaching, you know, I just wanted to fix everyone, and I wanted to, like, be that strong adult for everyone, and that was obviously, I mean, impossible. And I mean, you just can't do that job without burning out, and that was really hard. It was rewarding in a lot of ways that my current job is not, just like the emotional connection to the kids, and just like actually feeling like I was making a difference for them, even in a small way. My current school, if they had the shittiest teacher in the world, they would still be fine. You know, like, they're all really smart, they have parents who care. But at UAMA, my old school, I felt like I was actually doing something, like, I was being a good teacher for them, and even if they weren't learning that much from me, I was at least being, like, a positive, like, adult role model. And for me, that felt really important. But I just couldn't keep on doing it. I was honestly more of a social worker than I was a teacher, and were simply not properly trained to do that. And I think that if they want teachers to be prepared, they really need to be giving them more sort of social work training, and or just how to deal with, I mean, these kids are emotionally traumatized in a way that, like, most people that I know could never really understand. And just learning how to help them deal with that, and even, I mean, it just totally changes the dynamics of a classroom. Like, it's just not the same thing. So I was there for 3 years, and now I'm at still a public school, but it's a gifted and talented. Well, the middle school is, the K-8 is gifted and talented, and then the high school is just kind of general admission, but they get some kids from, like, the gifted and talented program. And so that is a very different population. So in order to get into these programs in New York, it's really like your parents have to be in the know. They have to be well-educated, they have to know how to work the system, They have to know what neighborhoods to live in. They have to know how to do the application, how to get everything in on time. So most of, pretty much all of my kids are middle class, and then some of them are kind of like what we call recession parents, like the parents who before the recession could afford private tuition but no longer can, so they send them to a public school like Nest, which is well known for being a good school. So just the fact it's such a, the difference that class makes is astounding. These kids have been read to since they were little. Their parents push them to, get straight A's. They check their homework. They do the readings with them. They talk to their teachers. And then they have time to do all of this, right? It's not like they're working two or three jobs and just, like, trying to pay the rent. Like, they're, they have, these kids have stay-at-home moms who, like, can monitor this stuff, and parents who went to college and can help them with their math homework. They're also, they also buy into the system. The system's worked for their parents, right? So, like, an authority figure in a school, like a teacher in a school, like, deserves respect. Like, the system works for them. And a lot of times, like, at my old school, teachers would come in expecting to be respected because they were an authority figure, when the truth of the matter is, like, that system wasn't working for these kids and for their families, and so they had no respect just because we were a teacher in a school. Like, it was one of those things where, like, you had to earn it. And a lot of people, I think that's where the biggest pitfall is for teachers in underserved schools, is that they come in expecting that they deserve respect when they, you just have to earn it. You have to build relationships with the kids. But at Nest, it's a total cakewalk. Like, I walk in and I'm like, do this, and they do it. So it's definitely less of a challenge, which is nice in a way, because I feel like I can be a teacher, and like I'll write my lesson plans and they'll work, and I'll be like, oh, okay, like you already know how to read at an eighth grade level, so I can just assign you this reading and you'll do it, and if you don't, I'll email your mom and you'll do it, and it's like it was a huge paradigm shift for me, but it was, I guess, a shift back into the sort of learning environment that I was used to growing up in. So, but it's funny because you hear teachers at my current school kind of complain about how kids are so bad, and, oh, they were talking, and so talked back to me. And I was like, really? You just have no idea. Like, these kids, they're fine. Like, come on, like, you need to take it easy. But I guess it's just the experience. I will never do a job that was harder than teaching at UAMA those first 3 years. After doing that, I can do anything. Anything, it would be easier than that. But I would do it again. I would totally do it again, because it really, talk about like a cultural ambassador. Like, honestly, people do not extend beyond their class lines. All of my friends are teachers. All of them are young professionals for the most part. And I never really knew anyone who was on welfare or had food stamps or, lived in the projects. And, I just realized just, like, how incredibly naive and ignorant I was, in a way that, like, I had no idea I was that ignorant until I started teaching at UMA. So it was, I learned way more from those kids than I ever taught them, that's for sure.
That was great. It was a powerful experience.
Yeah, it was.
Where exactly was that school?
It was at Flatbush and Tillery, right off the BQE, right by the Fort Greene projects. Kind of that wasteland that isn't like cool Dumbo, but it's right where the Manhattan Bridge comes into Brooklyn.
And most of those kids at that school were from?
From the surrounding projects, mm-hmm. Yeah, or like Bed-Stuy or East New York. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, very, very different from the kids at my school who are from Park Slope or the Upper East Side or like Greenwich Village.
And where exactly is the school?
Nest is on the Lower East Side. It's at Avenue D and Houston. So M14D.
And the kids come from all over the city and in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's a good school. It attracts a lot of people. All the recession parents. The parents are way more intense, though, that's for sure. Man, they're just like, they're on you. They are. But luckily I'm organized, so I know what I'm doing.
Can you give an example of how the parents are on you in the school, whereas they wouldn't be in
well,
the old school?
I get parents who are pissed because their kid got a 94. Not necessarily at me, but at the kid. Like, why does my kid not have a 99 or a 98? And I think the other thing about the school too is it does have a lot of cultural diversity. So we have a lot of like recent Asian immigrants who are very, very like concerned about school and just getting top grades and everything. So like a 94, 95 isn't good enough. And so I get that, and I get, you know, parents, you know, email. I spend a good, I would say, 4 or 5 hours every week emailing parents or talking to them on the phone, asking me, like, what are the projects? Why did my kid get X on this test? Can you help him with extra test prep? He has cello lessons the day you have test prep. Can you, like, take another extra day, like, after school that you can spend time with my kid, who's already going to get a perfect score on the stupid state test, so why am I spending an hour of my time with them? Or I had a kid, actually this year I had a kid, it was sad, who was diagnosed with leukemia, and so he was pulled out of school and was getting, I guess the DOE had sent a teacher, they have like special teachers that go to hospitals, but like he or she wasn't doing a very good job, and so his best friend's mom, who was advocating for him because his parents are Japanese and don't speak English that well, she was like trying to convince me to do like an hour-long Skype session with him every week to like teach him everything. And it's like, I felt bad, but forget it. Like, I'm spread too thin as it is. And I said, listen, I can send him the materials and I'd be happy to like email back and forth with him, but it's too much. Honestly, teaching, it's great, but it's there aren't enough hours in the day to do everything you should be doing for the 100, and I teach 150 kids. And they all need individual attention, and they're all individuals who, you know, have different skills and different desires and different loves and hates, and it's a lot. We don't get paid enough.
Is that as many as you had in your old school?
Mm-mm. And my old school was actually nice. It was, they really prided themselves on having small classes. So I would only have 20 to 25 students in a class, and I only taught 4 periods. So it was closer to, you know, depending on the year, like 85 to 100 students. But teaching a class of 20 of those kids was definitely way harder than teaching my 34 Nest students who all want to get A's.
Yeah, can you describe that, just the environment of those two classrooms?
Well, at UAMA, in every class, there was always someone who I would be nervous would randomly get up and start a fight. Or like stab someone with a pen or like pull out a weapon. So it was kind of about keeping them focused on me, but also like monitoring all of the little interactions that were happening amongst all of them. I mean, everybody's been to school before, so you all know that there are things that go on behind the teacher's back, like people are slipping notes or whatever. But in that classroom, like, you have to be, like, your antenna has to be, like, up and going, because you miss something and suddenly you have a fight on your hands where someone could get hurt. And then also, like, there's always going to be the kid who's going to want to pick a fight with you. And for me, it's got to be, with teaching, it's really so much about your own personality and your own style. There's never one way to do it. But for me, the way that I worked with these kids was a combination of being, like, super strict, but also diffusing it with humor and, like, showing them that I respected them. So I would just kind of be, like, it's hard to describe. Like, you know, I'd have a kid, I'd say, okay, whoever, Tashin, you gotta get up and sit on the other side of the room because you're talking to Malik and it's like, forget it, I can't teach like this. And she would be like, nah, I'm not moving. And so you can either go one of two ways. You can escalate as a teacher and be like, no, you're moving, like I'm telling you to, and the kid says no, and then you say yes, and the kid says fuck you, and like it turns into this whole thing. But instead, like, my style would just be like, listen, Tashin, if you don't get up, I'm gonna go to your house and kill your dog, so you better get up and move. And, like, so I just take it, like, to this, like, crazy level, and they'd be like, oh, Miss Snowden, you gangster, or, like, something stupid like that. And, like, Tashin would get up and move, you know? And so it's, like, this, like, fake strictness coupled with, like, humor, and that just, like, worked for me. Because also, like, what I'm gonna, like, I'm not gonna go to his house and kill his dog. Like, I am, like, this tiny, like, 26-year-old girl, like, no, I'm not gonna do that, like, and it was just, like, the combination of, the irony there was so obvious to everyone that it sort of worked for whatever reason, but it wouldn't work for everyone. But honestly, like, people just, like, trying to fight, like, and get, like, people who got, like, the ego thing of, like, having to have the authority and being right all the time, it just doesn't work. And then in my classroom now, I just tell the kid to move and he gets up and moves. Like, I don't have to tell him to kill his dog. Like, honestly, I'm just like, you're talking too much. Or I just say, like, stop talking. And the kid will stop talking. Like, they're just trained. They are 100%, like, trained, you know, Pavlov or something. But it just, like, it's so easy.
Do you remember when you first moved to your classroom where you are now? And was the change jarring?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because, I also, like, didn't really know how to interact with them. Because I would be, like, I started off with, like, my kind of tough guy show, and it was a little much for them. They were kind of scared of me. And I was like, oh, I don't mean to scare you. They're like, oh, you're really strict. You're really mean. I was like, oh, really? Because I'd gotten so used to just being, like, out there and, like, just pouring on, like, the sort of abrasive humor. And they were just, like, a little taken aback. I was like, oh, I guess I gotta tone it down. But, yeah, that was funny. I was also teaching, well, I was teaching an older grade. At UAMA, I only taught ninth grade students. And at NEST, I was teaching 9 and 11. So my 11th graders, it's very different. I mean, like, some of my 9th graders at UMA were, like, 18, but for the most part, they were, like, 14, 15. But the 11th graders were different, because they thought, like, they could be friends with me, because I also look young. I'm like, no, you can't be friends with me, and that's really weird. So navigating that was hard for me, which is why I'm actually glad to be teaching 8th grade, because now there's, like, there's a clear separation, whereas the juniors thought that, like, we would hang out. I'm like, no, I'm not hanging out with you. That's weird. But yeah, so that's the difference in a nutshell.
Seb, I'm interested. Did you hear these stories from her when she would come home about this classroom that was more challenging?
Yes. And I would get scared. Like the time she, like one of the students brought a gun.
Mm.
So that was scary because you never know what could happen in those kind of schools. So I was a little worried. So I was happy when she transferred to this new high school. Yeah, I heard a lot of stories. Like there was that, there was the fight with like one of your students like punch a police
in
the face.
Well, she actually attacked him from behind and tried to choke him.
Yeah. Yeah, crazy, like every week there will be like a new crazy story like that, so that was stressful.
But yeah, because I would also be the idiot to, like, always want to get in the middle of it to, like, stop it. Because there's nobody around. There's nobody around. Like, there's supposed to be school safety officers. Like, there's supposed to be a dean. But, like, when it hits a fan, nobody's there except for you. You're the one in that classroom with two kids going at it. And, like, you're not supposed to throw yourself in the middle, but dummy that I am, I would always do that. But luckily nothing happened to me.
Yeah.
So there was no game plan for when that happened?
When kids had a gun?
Kids would start fighting, or there would be
something. They'd say,
violent.
Call the dean's office, and you'd call and it would ring. No one would pick up. And, the thing with the gun, it was one of my students, Sean, who was, he was Crip. Well, his cousin was serious Crip, and he was, like, you know, a wannabe, kind of. But he was, wandering the hall with his cell phone out and just being kind of, like, suspicious. And when my last period class came in, they were all, like, bouncing off the walls, like, going crazy. Like, they were all really... It's one of those things, like, you learn the flavors of the craziness of the kids, and this one was, like, really anxiety-filled. Like, the kids were scared, and they didn't know how to express it, and so they were, like, bouncing off the walls, and I was like, wait a second, like, this isn't just your typical, like, it's Friday, last period, I want to get out of school. It was more than that, so I was like, what is going on? And one of the kids is like, Sean has a gun, and I was like, and they're like, yeah, I got it from his cousin, who went to school in the same building, because there are, like, four different high schools in our building. So I was like, okay. So Sean is supposed to be in my class up here, but he was wandering the halls. Our stupid assistant principal, Rob, he comes in with Sean, and he's like, Miss Snowden, Sean is supposed to be in your class, like as if I had done something wrong by not having him in the class. Fine. So he pushes Sean into my room, and he's about to go, and I was like, Rob, and like I run out, and he's like, what? And like I have my whole class behind me, including Sean, like watching my every move. So I have my back to that, and I'm like, and Rob's like, oh, yeah, I'll take care of it, okay. And I was like, what? So he turns around and leaves. So meanwhile, like, kid with, who ostensibly has a gun, chilling in my classroom, so I'm just like, okay. So I kind of go on with my lesson, and nothing happens, and the last period ends, and, the kids file out, and I'm like looking around for, like, I was like, why haven't they pulled Sean out? So I go and I talk to the principal, actually, you know what? No, I didn't talk to him that day. I just kind of figured that they would have pulled Sean before I left the building, but I didn't hear anything about it. So the next morning, I went and talked to my principal, and I was like, so, like, what happened with that? And he's like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, like, didn't Rob tell you about Sean and, like, the whole gun thing? And he's like, oh, yeah, he said you mimed something at him, but he didn't really get it. And I was like, what? He's like, you really have to be more clear, if something like that happens. I was like, so you didn't talk to Sean? He's like, no, he just left the building. And I was like, and you didn't talk to Rob? He's like, well, he didn't really know what you were saying, apparently. I was like, the kids were right behind me, like, I made a gun sign with my hand, and I said he had a gun. And, so, in the eyes of the administration, it was my fault for not being, more clear about the situation. But a couple of years before that, there is another situation with a couple of kids actually passing a gun around in school. And they had established some stupid, like, code Bluebird, which they were going to say over the loudspeakers that meant something, but nobody ever... Like, the plan, there was really never any real plan. And it's always the teacher's fault, too, for not, reacting. Even though we don't know, we were never really counseled as to what to do if such a thing happened. Yeah.
we have probably just a few minutes left. Do you guys want to talk about anything else? Do you want to talk about moving into this apartment?
You can go, Sebi.
So, yeah, our lease was coming to an end at the other apartment.
Thankfully.
And Vanessa started to look around. We started to look around the online,
mm-hmm.
but like for a day or two, because she was talking about looking for an apartment at school. One of your colleagues used to live here, and he said that that apartment is
available.
You
yeah.
should go check it out. So we were living in Jefferson Street stop, which is 3 or 4 stops away from this place. So we visited one night, and we decided practically like the night.
Yeah, it was a really easy search.
Because yeah. what we liked the neighborhood, because where we used to live was more industrial, like a lot of warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
There were only one nice little bar/restaurant
right.
in our street. Here there's a lot, and we like the place too. We have the backyard, and it was
a lot quieter
than the other place.
Because
so.
There's a family upstairs,
yeah.
and like the owners live upstairs. It's not like our old landlord who's never
mm-hmm.
around. It has the backyard and the pool and the grill and. And it was a really reasonable price too, because they gave us a pretty good deal because they, because I was referred by like my colleague, whom they are essentially best friends with. So that was great, and it was also nice to get something through who you know. It just makes such a huge difference here than to just look up a random ad or go through a broker. So you didn't have to go through a broker or anything, so we saved money on that, too. So it was nice. It worked out really well.
Mm-hmm.
It worked out really well. Oh, my gosh. That first apartment was such a nightmare. I don't know how we got through it.
Can I ask questions?
Sure.
Will you describe the apartment?
This one?
Yeah, so it can be recorded.
Oh. Okay, so we're sitting in the living room right now, and it's, I guess, what, like 7 or 8 feet by 7 or 8 feet? I'm really bad at that sort of stuff. And then behind us is our tiny kitchen, which is probably 3.5 feet wide and is stuffed to the brim with lots of goodies to cook with. And then at the end of the kitchen, there's like a tiny bathroom where one person can fit, or two if one of them is sitting on the toilet and the other one's in the shower. But otherwise, it's very small. And then off of the living room is Mimi's room, who's lying on the couch right now. So Mimi's our dog, not our kid. But she might as well be our kid. So she has her own, like, dog room, which is pretty luxurious for her. And then there's Seb's office where he, since he works from home, doing the tours and stuff, and it also doubles as an extra sort of guest bedroom if we have people visiting. And then we have our little bedroom, which is across from the guest one. So it works. It's nice. It's more of a square apartment than our old one was a railroad. It feels cozier, probably redo the floors, but that's okay.
Did you paint it when you moved in?
Yeah, we painted it.
Painted the kitchen.
Yeah, the kitchen is yellow, and then there's a little arch that we painted red, and then the wall, the one wall of the living room is sort of a deep blue. My mom helped us pick out the colors.
Yeah. Otherwise, the other walls are there.
Our bedroom, my dad painted.
Oh, yeah, we painted
the
bedroom.
Yeah, it's purple.
Yeah.
But the other walls, I keep on saying I'm going to paint them over the summer.
Yeah, the plan was to paint those other walls.
Yeah.
But
still a plan.
Yeah.
Do you know how old this building is?
I would say...
I don't know. It feels old.
35 years old. I would say like in the 70s, right?
That's what I would say,
yeah.
It's a little crooked.
When you eat soup,
you notice that the floors aren't really straight, and one has to pour the soup accordingly.
Yeah, we can see the paper.
Yeah, we have paper.
Try to level the table a little bit.
Right, we have paper underneath the legs of the table, two of the table legs, in order to level our eating surface.
But we have a nice backyard.
We do. Also makes the meme star happy. And our friends when we have pool parties.
Sounds good.
Any last questions for us?
Do you think you... How long do you foresee yourselves living in Brooklyn?
That's hard. We kind of... Initially, when we came to New York, it was only for 2 years. And we've been here for 6. And
What
were you going to say?
No.
I thought you were
going to
say something.
Yeah, there's not really a plan. It's not day to day, but... I mean, we both have jobs. We both have jobs, so.
And we like it here for now.
Yeah.
Seb, he loves it.
Yeah.
Seb is a real New Yorker. Sometimes I feel like I could use some more, like, garden and outdoors stuff. Sometimes I feel like I'm over the hustle and bustle of the city. But there's always pros and cons with everything. And right now we're happy here. We don't have kids yet, so it's kind of it's a good time to live here.
Great. Well, I think I'll end it there.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was fun.